Welcome to the podcast of The Diane Rehm Show, smart conversation and civil dialogue from WAMU and NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Verizon Wireless, working to constantly strengthen the connection quality and reliability of its network. Verizon Wireless, our people, our network.
Joining us, I'm Diane Rehm. In recent weeks, concerns about lead-contaminated toys imported from China have been making headlines. Lead has long been identified as a toxin that leads to violent behavior. Now, new research suggests a strong connection between levels of lead poisoning and fluctuations in crime rates 20 years later. Joining me in the studio to talk about how lead levels affect behavior and the implications of this latest research, Rick Nevin. He's an economic consultant. Ellen Silbergeld is professor of environmental health sciences at Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. And by phone from Pittsburgh, Dr. Herbert Needleman. He's professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh. Throughout the hour, I'll look forward to hearing your questions and comments. Join us on 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. First, we're joined by Rachel Weintraub. She's Director of Product Safety for the Consumer Federation of America. Good morning, Rachel. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. It's an honor to be here.
Thank you. Rachel, can you talk about how lead gets into the products we're concerned about, be it toys, be it jewelry, be it any of the other consumer products?
Sure. Well, first of all, our method of manufacturing has become increasingly global, and the manufacturing process, therefore, has become more and more of an arm's-length transaction, where before a manufacturer may have been based in Illinois and the product would have been made in Illinois and then sold throughout the country or the world. But now that most products are being made in China, this transaction is much more removed and more contractual. Unfortunately, what seems to be occurring is that most manufacturers, let's say it's an American manufacturer, have a contract to manufacture with a company, many of which are in China, for toys. And it seems that with lead, what happens is we don't know if it's knowing or unknowing, but there's a supplier who uses lead either in paint or, in the case of jewelry, that's embedded in the product itself. And there's no testing done externally by an independent third party to document the presence of lead throughout the manufacturing process.
But can you explain why the lead is used in the first place?
Well, lead is cheaper. It's a dull metal, and it, in terms of paint, it dries faster. So really, it's a decision based on cost.
But what about in toys and in jewelry?
It's the same reasons. I mean, the reason why most entities go to China to manufacture their products is because it's a less expensive process, and unfortunately, safety is being sacrificed. In terms of toys, I mean, the massive recall that Mattel and Fisher-Price are undertaking right now, there's lead on the paint, and that was used, it's unclear whether it was used knowingly or unknowingly by the contract manufacturer, but lead is used because it dries faster.
So how big a problem do you believe this to be right now with toys that may not have been recalled but are actually in this country? Is it a specific 2-year period, 3-year? What's the range?
Well, it's sort of hard to say how the time period of this problem. First of all, we don't know from the Fisher-Price-Mattel recall who the actual manufacturer was. So we don't know if other companies have made products with that company. But in terms of how broad a problem this is a significant problem in the United States. Obviously, manufacturers should not be producing toys that pose harm to children. In terms of lead in paint, the law is unambiguous. Since 1978, there's been a law that bans paint with lead in it from being in children's products. In terms of jewelry, there's a rulemaking that's going on currently at the Consumer Product Safety Commission that would make products that contain more than 0.06% lead a banned hazardous product. But it is a problem that we need reforms to change to prevent these products from getting into the marketplace.
What kinds of reforms are you talking about?
Well, first of all, the Consumer Product Safety Commission needs vastly more resources. There are reports.
How much power does that organization actually have?
That's sort of a hard question to answer. I mean, they are the government agency. They're an independent government agency with jurisdiction over consumer products, which are toys, appliances, televisions. And so basically, Americans are in contact with products that CPSC has jurisdiction over pretty much every second of their day. So they have huge impact on the lives and safety of Americans. Unfortunately, their budget has been pretty much decimated since the 1980s. Their staff is at 401 employees, the lowest in history. They are forced to reevaluate their goals. They're limited in what they could do. And just in terms of ports, they have 15 employees working at the ports of this country. So they need an infusion of resources of qualified staff.
I think Helen Silbergill would like to ask a question or make a comment.
I would. Thank you. Certainly, CPSC has been underfunded and undermandated ever since it was formed. But this is a problem that has to be stopped at the source. We're never going to catch up with these kinds of products as they flow through globalized commerce.
So whose responsibility is it? Is it Mattel? Is it the other toy makers? Whose is it?
I think what really has to happen is to complete an undertaking that started about 20 years ago in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development and get a global ban on most uses of lead. And that way, it can be enforced through World Trade Organization and other methods which allow these kinds of compacts to occur.
Do you believe that's possible, Rachel Weintraub?
I am not an expert in trade, but we certainly believe that the problem does need to be stopped at the source. And one of the proposals that we have been advocating for years is that these products be tested at various stages of the supply chain by an independent third party to ensure that these products meet voluntary and mandatory standards.
Then, finally, what should consumers themselves be doing right now?
Well, first, they need to find out whether a product that they own or have in their possession has been recalled.
So how?
They should go to the CPSC website, which is www.cpsc.gov. And you could go to their recall page. There's ways to search by type of toy, by manufacturer, and see if a toy that you own has been recalled. If it has been recalled, take the toy away from your child immediately. And also, then contact the manufacturer and go through. I know, you know, having children myself, it's very hard to go through this clunky process. You just want to throw away the toy. But it's very useful for the manufacturers to know that you have the toy, that you're going through that process.
All right. And I do want to offer further information to our listeners, to consumers. There's a website, www.service.mattel.com, or you can call Fisher-Price at 800-916-4498. 8. And we'll have those numbers and that website available. I do think this is something parents are going to be concerned about and will want to have further information on. What do you see as your next task, Rachel?
Well, what we're trying to do is, first of all, the CPSC, in addition to some of its weaknesses, it was without a quorum since January, but they recently just got their quorum back last Friday through an amendment being added to 9/11.
What does that mean? Has the CPSC under the Bush administration been totally lacking in any authority because it had no quorum?
Yes. Basically, they were unable to conduct official business because the previous chairman resigned a year ago in July. And by statute, they can keep their quorum as if they are a full commission for 6 months, but that expired, and no one has been confirmed.
And why is that?
Well, the Bush administration nominated Mr. Baroudi, who is a vice president from the National Association of Manufacturers, and consumer groups and other groups opposed his nomination due to his lifelong work with manufacturers. And many senators also opposed his nomination, and he ultimately withdrew his nomination.
So now they have a quorum. So what's next?
Well, first of all, they have a rulemaking that is in ongoing that hopefully they'll be able to finalize in these next 6 months that would basically make it a banned prohibited product if by weight a product contained more than this is on jewelry only, 0.06% lead under the Federal Hazardous Substances Act. So that's one thing that the commission's doing. Unfortunately, this rulemaking is narrowly tailored to jewelry, and there's other issues. What's ironic about the CPSC's jurisdiction over lead is that lead in paint in children's products is banned. However, lead within products in another way is not specifically banned. So we need rulemakings on those issues as well. And then there's congressional efforts that we're pursuing also.
Rachel Weintraub, Director of the Product Safety for the Consumer Federation of America. Rachel, thanks for joining us.
Thank you very much.
And when we come back, we'll talk about the health effects of lead and what you should do to stay safe. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're now going to shift the conversation to talk about the effects of lead on human health, rather than talking about the toys and jewelry, which Rick Nevin says happens to be a very, very small portion of the problem. Rick, you said that the problem with old paint remains a far larger issue.
Yeah, there is no question not to understate the importance of these other dangers, and they obviously do need to be addressed. But in terms of the large numbers of children that are still affected by lead poisoning, you have data at the national level that shows where those children are by the age of their home, and you can see the risk gets greater, the severity of the poisoning gets greater as the house gets older. And the reason for that is because the use of lead in paint, the concentration of lead in paint, actually peaked around 1900 to 1910 or 1920.
I see.
And it declined, you know, from 1920 through 1960. It wasn't entirely banned until 78, but relatively little was used after 1960. So pre-1940 homes are where the greatest risk are. Pre-1960 is still a significant risk, and you will find lead paint in homes built up through 1978.
And let's talk about that risk. Dr. Herbert Needleman of the University of Pittsburgh Medical School, you've been doing some research as to how lead actually affects our bodies. Talk about that, please.
Lead is a potent and versatile poison. It affects so many targets that it's difficult to say which is the most important. But among the most prominent are its effects on brains, and children's brains are the most sensitive. It piles up in the brain, particularly in the prefrontal lobes, that's up front of the forehead, where executive functions are mediated. That is, the decision-making of the brain resides in that area. And that may be responsible for the increase in antisocial behavior that accompanies lead exposure.
But now, how do you measure lead exposure in the first place, Dr. Needleman?
Well, the commonest way is to measure it in the blood. The concentration of lead in the blood is related to the amount of lead in the important targets. The half-life of lead in the blood is about 30 days, so that if exposure stops, the blood lead starts to decrease. But there are other places one can look for lead. The half-life of lead in bone is about 30 years. So that's a way of looking back into the history of a child. We have instrumentation that enables us to do that.
Ellen Silbergale, then turning to you, what's the incidence of lead poisoning in this country today as opposed to 30 years ago?
That's a more complicated question than it might seem, because two things have happened. As Rick Nevin's paper shows, and studies from the government as well, major sources of lead have in fact declined. Gasoline notably, lead in some areas for drinking water, and to some extent in some cities with varying records, exposures to lead in housing. So overall, there has been a decline in the average or median blood lead levels in the U.S. population by over 90% from the peak of around 1976, taking the earliest data from the CDC, and Mr. Nevin's paper has even earlier, to the present time. But at the same time as this has been achieved, our understanding of the hazards of lead, both of the developing brain, as Dr. Needleman suggests, and for other endpoints of concern, that concern has increased, so that we're really unsure, if you will, what levels of lead not really poisoning. And if I could put this in a certain context, a former student of mine did a really elegant study utilizing a series of bones going way back in history and showed that, in fact, the lowest levels of lead in humans today is about 100 to 1,000 times higher than the average levels of exposure that probably existed around 1500 AD.
How do you account for that, Rick?
Well, the exposure to lead in paint and then lead in gasoline was just absolutely pervasive.
But if we're talking about 1500 years ago, you're not talking...
No, 500 years ago.
500 years ago, all right, still...
Probably industrialization.
Uh-huh.
A whole range of smelting processes released lead. But the big bang for lead is clearly what happened in the 20th century with this, you know, unholy mixture of dilapidated, steadily dilapidated housing and increasing vehicular traffic with leaded gasoline.
One other thing, Rick, you're the author of new research relating lead levels to crime rates. What did you actually set out to study?
Well, I actually had one study published in 2000 that was an outgrowth of work I was doing on the economic analysis for a HUD rule on lead paint hazards in federally assisted housing. And in the sensitivity analysis for that, there was actually my first graph of the rise and fall of gasoline lead versus the rise and fall of the violent crime rate in the United States. And it's a rather stunning fit. It sits, you know, the rise and fall of crime sits on the rise and fall of gasoline lead with a 23-year lag. Well, we know that lead especially affects the brain's development in the very first years of life, and gasoline lead had also strong effects on maternal blood lead and affected prenatal brain development. And we know that the peak age of offenders is sometime, it varies with the crime category, but with violent crime, it's about 23 years. So what I found in that study was that there was an incredibly good fit in the United States in the second half of the century between violent crime and the rise and fall of gas lead. I also showed that there was an equally stunning fit in the first half of the century between the rise and fall of paint lead use and the rise and fall in the murder rate in the United States from 1900 to 1960. Now, what I've done with my new study is I've extended this to 8 other countries, and I've also extended it to look at property crimes as well as violent crimes and the combination of the two, which is called index crimes. And because the United States had such a disproportionate share of the automobiles before 1960 and even really before 1970, the lead exposure levels were much worse in the United States at that time. We did get lead out of gasoline faster than a lot of our European and...
So wouldn't that lead us to the beginnings, at least, of a decline?
Exactly. And what I've shown is that despite these very different patterns in the rise and fall of lead exposure in children's blood lead levels in these different countries, within each country, the crime rate has risen and fallen right with the same time lag. And the time lags for different crime categories fit what we know about the typical age of offenders for different crime categories.
Dr. Needleman, what do you make of these studies?
Well, it's been known for quite a while that lead increases antisocial behavior. The first studies done by Randolph Byers at Boston Children's Hospital were done because he was referred to children who had attacked their teacher, and he recognized them as children he had treated for lead poisoning. That led him to go on to study children in Boston who had been discharged as cured, and he found that a high percentage of them were aggressive, overactive, or very hard to manage. And the Rick study is a very important contribution to this area, but he's not alone in that. Deborah Deno, a lawyer and epidemiologist, showed that the principal cause of arrest in Philadelphia male school children was a history of lead poisoning. Our own work supports that. We found that, looking at high school children in Pittsburgh, that the those who were arrested had 4 times the lead in their body as those who from the same schools who were not known to be antisocial.
So you're saying that your work was looking at young people in juvenile detention centers.
That's correct.
How does lead lead to violent behavior, Dr. Needleman?
Well, for a number of things. First is its effect on the prefrontal lobes in the brain, where decisions are made about the consequences of behavior. That causes increased impulsivity, which I think is the central lesion in crime, that is not paying attention to the consequences that follow a given act. If I do this, I'm going to get in trouble, so I won't do it. If that's faulty, then you might be subject to more antisocial behavior. The second is it increases the blood levels of a porphyrin-like substance, and it may be that this is a consequence, or that the antisocial behavior is a consequence of increase in porphyria. And it has many other effects on neurotransmitters and other vulnerable areas in the brain.
I guess this kind of research, Ellen Silbergild, has been met with a certain amount of skepticism for a number of years. Is that now changing?
I don't really think it's met with that much skepticism. The studies on lead, including notably the ones conducted by Dr. Needleman, are some of the best epidemiologic studies we have in the entire area of public health. These are very carefully designed studies in which children were actually enrolled while their mothers were pregnant and have been followed from that time forward now to the late teen, early adult years. So a great deal is known about those children. I think the ability to integrate the national statistical databases that Rick Nevin has carried out certainly took a different kind of training and intelligence to carry out, but they're not inconsistent. And I just give one anecdote also from the world of experimental research on lead, which has, I think, been very closely allied to the epidemiological and clinical research. That is in some studies that a student of mine, Lynn Calvin, carried out. She found that when mice were exposed to very low levels of lead early in their brain development and then put in a situation to see how aggressive they would be, the lead-treated animals were very aggressive, but there was something extremely disturbing about their aggression. Normally, when two rats fight, one will get the better of the other, and the other puts its head down, hunches its shoulders, and sort of says, "Uncle," in rat signaling. And normally, then, that's the end of the fight among animals. But with the lead animals, they kept on fighting, and they kept on biting and attacking a submissive animal, and in fact had to be separated to save the animal. And that's a level of really vicious aggression that's quite disturbing.
Ellen Silbergild, and she is at the Johns Hopkins University. And at 27 before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. It's time to open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. First to Howley, Massachusetts. Good morning, Jade. You're on the air.
Good morning. Yes, I am a window restoration specialist, and I work with my share of lead. And my concerns are twofold. When we remove from a home, we are opening ourselves to liability, especially.
Jade, I'm afraid you're breaking up on us. Perhaps you can call us on a landline.
I am on a landline. I'm sorry. Can you hear me now?
Okay, go ahead.
I'm sorry. So my concerns are because there's so much information now out in the public about lead, is that the folks like myself who do window restoration are opening ourselves to liability.
I don't understand the liability. What are you saying?
When we remove the windows, we're disturbing the opening, which contains lead paint. And then I'm bringing the windows to my shop, removing all the lead paint and repainting it, reinstalling it. And if a child in the home later tests with a high blood level, that's where the liability comes in. So there's a number of us who do window restoration, and we're all concerned about this, and we're all taking classes to certify ourselves on safe lead removal.
All right, Ellen.
Well, I think you should be concerned about your own health as well. There's certainly a number of case reports of people involved in your profession who have, in fact, poisoned themselves.
How are you protecting yourself, Jade?
I wear a respirator, I wear gloves, and I do test my blood level once a year.
Does that do it?
Well, you probably need to test your blood level a little bit more often, but I think that you're in Massachusetts, and there's very excellent state programs, as you probably know, in both training and follow-up for renovation and restoration.
All right. Thanks for calling, Jade. Good luck to you. Now to Baltimore, Maryland. Good morning, Nathan. Thanks for joining us.
Yes, I have a background working with the Maryland State Department of Education evaluating students at risk in middle schools. And I have noticed that in areas outside of Baltimore City where students live in the same social environment have less violent behavior. And I'm concerned about, is there a way to take a medical approach to this problem rather than a social environment approach that's being used today? And who can I contact with consideration for the lead paint in the housing that are still being used to house poor?
Interesting question, Ellen.
Well, probably the ultimate way that society is going to help protect children like the ones you deal with, sir, is through a social environmental approach. In terms of attempting to intervene after the exposures, certainly there are behavioral and educational programs that can be helpful. I'm sure Dr. Needleman can expand on this, but the large NIH trial did not find a benefit of treating children with drugs after they had been lead poisoned.
Dr. Needleman.
Well, that's Ellen's correct. The collaborative study did not show any long-term advantage in children who received the drug that we now use, which is very good for clinical poisoning.
What is that drug, Dr. Needleman?
It's called Succimer, S-U-C-C-I-M-E-R.
And it's used to treat individuals who have high levels of lead in their blood.
Exactly. It causes a profound decrease over time. But in those children who have lower levels, below 45 and above 10, there was no long-term benefit from getting it. The one thing...
Well, hold on one second. The question becomes, once it's out of the blood, does that necessarily mean it's out of the brain?
That's a very good question.
And I'll have to ask you to hold your answer until after we take just a short break. Dr. Herbert Needleman is professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School. And when we come back, we'll tackle that question and many, many more. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, helping to build a more just future for the nation and the world at macfound.org. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And from Ann and John Herman, supporting City Year and the young adults who dedicate a year of their lives to community service and leadership development. CityYear.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, devoted baseball fan Zach Hample has managed to turn his obsession into a profession. He gives high-priced guided tours to ball games with a money-back guarantee you'll get a ball from the field. His new book is an insider's guide to the game called Watching Baseball Smarter. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
We're back talking about the effect of lead on human beings. High levels of lead found in gasoline, in paint. Recently, there's been a great deal of concern about lead found in toys imported from China. According to our guest, that has just been a very tiny drop in the bucket. Dr. Needleman, just before the break, we were talking about the reduction of lead blood levels, but what happens to the brain once it has been affected?
Yeah, we measure lead in the blood because it's easy to get to, but what we're really interested in is the concentration of lead at certain important sites, such as the brain. And it will come down gradually at a slower rate from that in the brain if we reduce the blood lead levels. But by that time, there probably have been changes made that are not good for the developing child, so that the only effective response to the problem of lead is primary prevention.
And Rick Nevin, that's where your studies come in, showing that even if there has been a one-time spike in that brain lead level, it's very difficult to reverse.
Well, there's a lot of research that demonstrates that early childhood is a critical phase of brain development. A lot of research specifically indicating how much damage can be done by lead at that age. And from prenatal development through about the age of 18 months or 2 years is the really critical window. And if children are exposed during that time, the effects that you can see when you step back and look at the societal trend now across 10 countries are extremely profound. Why one person is affected more than another can be related to diet. It can be related to biological variations in how vulnerable different people are. But when you look across the entire population, you see the statistical risk is enormous. And of course, that, as Ellen emphasized, is strongly reinforced by the earlier research and ongoing research done by Dr. Needleman and others in case-controlled studies. So the key thing is to eliminate the exposure in the first place.
And let's go to Dayton, Ohio. Good morning, Nancy. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I have a daughter who's just been diagnosed with autism, and the whole time I was pregnant and during the first 2 years of her life, we lived in a house that was built in 1889 and had, you know, different layers of paint. You could tell every time you opened the window it would chip a little bit. And I'm wondering if there's been any studies or there's any theories on the relationship between autism and lead, and I'll take my answer off the air.
All right. Thanks for calling, Dr. Needleman.
Yeah, there have been a lot of theoretical responses to that question. Lead is not proven to be involved in autism. The same question has been raised about mercury in vaccines. Neither agent has been demonstrated to be an unequivocal cause of autism.
When you use the word unequivocal, you raise my doubts, Dr. Needleman. Does that mean the suggestion could be there, but without proof as yet?
I think that's an accurate response, yes. Proving that that an agent is a cause of a disease is a difficult thing.
All right, here's an email from Laura, who says it's good to see people paying attention to the harm done by lead poisoning, but it seems that until middle-class children were threatened by imported toys, nobody much cared. In the city of Detroit, thousands of poor children are poisoned every year. The city recently received $4 million for lead abatement. It's not enough. Sadly, babies in Detroit are being poisoned as we speak, decades after the harm was recognized. Why has it taken so long to help? How many poor children will be poisoned today? Rick Nevin.
Well, I have to say that it has struck me the same way, that there will periodically be a tremendous amount of anxiety expressed in the news media and by the public about a particular source of lead exposure that is suddenly in the news. The toy example is the most recent. There was one with mini blinds a few years ago. But we know from the data that the far more pervasive problem is in older housing. That's where the overwhelming majority of children are still being affected. And it is true that lower income children are much more affected because they're more likely to live in older housing, and they're more likely to live in housing that is not kept up well, that has deteriorated paint, and that creates more lead dust hazards.
Ellen?
Well, I also share the concern and outrage of the caller, having seen this over my career in Baltimore as well. But I think there's some other effects of lead which may well increase and broaden the basis for concern. We've been studying associations between really low levels of lead exposure. Blood lead's between 0.5 and 2 micrograms per deciliter, which describe a large number of people in the United States. And we've
probably all of us as
probably.
Well. Okay.
And we've reported very strong associations with increased risks of cardiovascular disease, mortality due to stroke, and atherosclerosis among adults, white and black, rich and poor. So lead itself is an equal opportunity poison. Mm. It's society that arranges for some people to be more at risk than others. But as we move to these lower and lower levels, I think it may well drive us to a much more active stance on this poison.
Here's an email from Terrence who says, is it true that Japan's leaded gas and paint has not led to an increase in that country's violent crime rate? Rick?
I did not. Japan was not one of the countries that I looked at. They actually eliminated or sharply reduced, I'm not sure which, the lead in gasoline very early on. So they were on top of this as early as anybody was in terms of lead in gasoline. I don't know about the extent of lead paint use or other sources of lead in Japan.
All right, to Norwich, Vermont. Good morning, Jim. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. Thank you. I have a 2-year-old son and 8-year-old daughter. Excuse me. And the type of exposure that's necessary for both of them, the son is obviously playing with toys. He's in daycare, et cetera. The daughter is into jewelry. How would they be most exposed? By putting the toys in their mouth early or by touching or by both? Or can you advise me there?
Dr. Needleman.
Well, both. If you put it in your mouth, you're certainly going to get a whopping dose. If you're talking about a lead soldier and the child rubs it or carries it around and then sucks his thumb, it's another way of transferring lead into the body.
So
can I speak a little bit about this issue of what to do about lead in
surely,
our body?
Surely.
If you map, as in a way what Rick has done, the places where lead has been piled up in excess, and then if you map where jobs are in short supply, the two maps are virtually identical. And that's one of the reasons that so little attention has been paid, is that it has been considered to be a disorder of black children. Now, the sensible response to this mismatch between high unemployment and excess lead would be to take the unemployed people and train them in de-leading and pay them. So the same dollar would take somebody off the welfare rolls, make them a taxpayer, and wipe out lead poisoning forever. Once you've de-leaded a house, it's safe until it's torn down. And the CDC once did a cost-benefit analysis of that, and they showed that the cost, this was in 1970, I think, the cost was $36 billion. But the benefit in terms of avoided special education, avoided health, was higher, so that there's a profit to be made from doing this. And actually, HUD began to do this in a pilot fashion, and then it was shut down by the administration.
We, as a society, have a hard time sort of coping with the reality of how much prevention will save us before such horrible outcomes appear. Let's go to Shelton, Connecticut. Good morning, Susan.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm a registered nurse who was working in a community health education program in Bridgeport, Connecticut, and our primary funding was for the detection and then education of lead in children in that city. And it seemed to me anecdotally, and we didn't study this, that a lot of the referrals we were getting from the federally funded health clinics were specifically for refugee children, and it didn't matter where the child had arrived from, whether they be Kurds, Liberians, Rwandans, and it just seemed that these children were the children that had elevated lead, so which led me to believe that as refugee children, perhaps having suffered a lapse in their nutritional supply. And the other question I have now, and this was, I was working about 7 years ago, around 2000, legislation. You know, I'm familiar with newborn screening programs for many metabolic disorders,
that different states legislate for newborns to be tested for other illnesses. And I'm curious as to what state legislation is like now throughout the country for mandating lead testing for young children.
Thanks for your call, Ellen.
There used to be a federally mandated program for screening all young children by the age of 2. Unfortunately, a variety of pressures led to an abandonment of that at the federal level, so that now it's more discretionary. Now, some states, I don't know about Connecticut, but I do know about Maryland and Massachusetts, in fact, have continued a mandated program that all children be screened at least once before the age of 2. So the burden seems to be on states to do this.
What about the question of nutrition, Rick Nevin? What role does that or might that play?
Well, it's very complicated, but just as one example, one of the ways that lead can profoundly affect the developing brain is by substituting for calcium. So calcium deficiency, you know, vitamin deficiencies, these things can increase the uptake of lead and the damage that lead does to the developing brain.
Ellen.
This is a very complex story, but it's also like the treatment trial that Dr. Needleman referred to, and that is that a deficiency is dangerous and can increase the absorption of lead and possibly delivery to sensitive places like the brain. But adding calcium or iron or zinc to an already adequate diet does not prevent lead absorption or poisoning. There have been a number of studies to do this. Lead is very powerful. And, you know, when it gets in the wrestling ring with an essential element, really lead wins.
Here's an email from Rick who says, why is there not more concern about lead coming from coal-burning power plants due to the weakening of environmental laws during the Bush administration? Many places now have an increase of lead in soils, water, etc. As an environmental scientist, I can tell you this is a far greater risk than any toy from China. Rick.
Well, I don't know about some of the things in that statement with respect to recent developments, but in fact, at a national level, industrial lead emissions were reduced substantially since the 1980s through the 1990s, you know, in addition to the phase-out of lead in gasoline. And once again, the air emissions that we had during the gasoline-lead era and from industrial emissions caused really pervasive problems, even children in remote areas.
At 6 minutes before the hour, you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. But the question becomes, is lead poisoning? Is the risk of lead poisoning on the increase? Ellen.
I would have to say, on balance, as we continually redefine the hazards of lead for adults and others, that it may well be on the increase. And I'd also like to point out that the hazards associated with toys, children's jewelry, and these other little coincident uses are very, very serious. One thing they do is they take lead into places that are lead safe. So someone who's made every single effort to remove all sources of lead, drinking water, housing, backyard soils, will bring home a toy to a child, and now lead has come back into that scene.
Dr. Needleman, how serious is the problem nationwide, worldwide?
Well, in the United States, the blood lead levels have come down dramatically, and clinical lead poisoning has decreased. But at the same time, more sensitive studies have shown effects of lead at levels that were once considered perfectly safe. When I started investigating this area, the definition of lead poisoning was 60 micrograms per deciliter. That's 100 cc's of blood. It then went down in steps by the CDC to 25. And then in the 1991, I believe, the definition was reset to 10.
Why?
And then in the past, since that time, since 92, 93, there have been a number of studies which show effects of lead on IQ scores below 10.
Oh, I see.
And the slope of the curve below 10 is steeper than above. In other words, more damage is done below 10 micrograms per deciliter than above. So that in terms of fluoride lead poisoning, we almost don't see it anymore. But in terms of slight measures, diminishing of skills, and other things that we haven't examined, it's increased because we have more sensitive ways of determining that.
One caller who couldn't get on says he works for the telephone company every day, handles lead all the time. What precautions should he take when he goes home? Ellen, very quickly, please.
Very quickly. Lead is a classic take-home poison from the workplace, and certainly he should first be certain that he has adequate occupational protection that'll protect him and also protect his family in terms of having clothing and gloves that can
be... So you're saying change clothes before you go home,
depending
take a shower.
Depending on the use. If he's using lead solders, if he's grinding or sanding things, he should probably have a work suit and gloves.
Dr. Ellen Silbergill, Professor of Environmental Sciences at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, Dr. Herbert Needleman. He's professor of psychiatry and pediatrics at the University of Pittsburgh Medical School, and economist Rick Nevin. Fascinating discussion. Thank you so much. And thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Jonathan Smith, and Tanya Weinberg. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annisman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives and CD sales, transcripts from SoftScribe, and podcasts.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.